Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Something amazing is happening in meteorology. Climate researchers are successfully processing a data storm. That's because CDW transformed their laptop devices and infrastructure to pre-configured Lenovo ThinkPads and powerful edge-to-cloud solutions. By delivering faster insights to run more accurate forecast models, it's almost like they're controlling the weather themselves. Lenovo and CDW, make amazing happen. Find out more at cdw.com/LenovoClient.
Hello, welcome to another exciting edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm here today with three co-hosts, Ben Ayong.
Hello.
Wave to the audience, complexity thinking coach. Serge Martin, systems team coach.
Hello.
And Jay, occasionally thinking coach. Did I get that right?
Yep, occasionally sounds about, that's the right adjective. Yep.
Occasionally I get to spell your name right on the show.
Just throw in some consonants with an O on the end. It looks fine.
So we got a group of four coaches. I don't know what that's called.
An argument.
We're pleased, very pleased to welcome back to the show, founder, chief scientific officer of Cognitive Edge, author of many publications on the development of narrative storytelling as a research method, and known to our audience and others for the development of the Kniffen framework for decision-making. Welcome back, Dave Snowden.
Pleasure to be here.
We had the opportunity to talk to you a couple years back, 2020, when you and Andrea Tomasini joined us for Making Sense in Times of Uncertainty. That was summer of 2020, right at the beginning of the new abnormal.
Back in the day.
And before that, 2018, Zombie Agile. I don't remember which of those two, but Dave, you introduced me to Ginventory, the app, which really upped my game on pairing gin, the right tonic, and the right garnish.
You'll have to come over. We have an event every year called Ginevin, where the whole team come together to consume my surplus gin.
I've seen photos of your inventory, and I'm hard-pressed to understand what surplus means in this context.
At the moment, mostly people bring more, so the stock goes up rather than down, so it's counterintuitive.
So today we invited Dave and the coaches here to talk about three models, most of them likely familiar in different degrees to our listening audience: spiral dynamics, integral theory, metamodernism. And our proposed approach is tackle them one at a time. Quick, short overview, not meant to be exhaustive. Maybe the coaches go around robin and share what we have found useful in these models. And then Dave, you get the other side of George Box's coin. What's wrong about them? No plot spoiler here. You've been pretty vocal about these three models. And during the setup and exchange of emails, you called them pseudoscience, cultism, and dangerously escapist political philosophy. We'll have to let the audience do a mix and match.
So I was being reasonable then.
We'll see where it goes.
So I'll give you a little bit of a lead in, Andy. So Dave, Andy reached out to you because we saw some of your comments on LinkedIn. And let's be real here. The Agile nerds, there have been cottage industries made out of these three things, especially in the Agile coaching space, right? Everybody, what's old is new again. Somebody discovers something and then they wanted to apply it to everything, make it universal and run off into the woods. And you had a post out there where you said, well, this is just kind of balderdash. I don't know what everybody's talking about. And that's what piqued my curiosity, because I kind of look at some of these things as, this is going to be a really ham-handed reference, but have anybody seen Predator 2? There's a scene where the Predator is up in the ceiling and he can't see the antagonist, so he keeps changing lenses until he finds the one that works. And I kind of view these things as, well, maybe, you know, in certain instances they work, but if you try to universally apply them, they'd be deadly, because you end up painting yourself into this weird sort of mental corner of everything needs to fit the model or else I'm crazy. And that was where I want to kind of pick your brain and see what is the story that we're not telling ourselves, that we're leading ourselves by the nose into some dangerous ground?
Okay, so there's a couple of direct problems, all right? And I would say generally it's not just Agile. There is an IT problem in general, in that largely because of the work they do on systems analysis, et cetera, they think if they've read one book, they're experts. And generally the books they read are, you know, airport bookshop stuff, i.e. simplistic recipes. So I still remember one conference in Sweden where somebody was creating a whole new offering around neuroscience applied to Agile. And it turned out they'd read one book, which is totally deprecated by the entire neuroscience community. And they hadn't checked further. And to be with regret, that is pretty typical, right? So there's a lack of due diligence in checking material before it's used.
Okay.
Yeah. And an assumption of expertise. So I think it's partly because of the way people code. The fact that you've read something doesn't mean you understand it. So to give an example, we develop methods and tools based on natural science. So we take natural science as an enabling constraint. We build a method or tool based on that. It takes us 4 to 5 years of practice before we launch it. Right. And things like Kinevin have evolved over 20 odd years and were 5 years in their initial formation. Right? Because you can't just throw something together, add a certificate onto it and go with it. But that's actually what too much of Agile is. And at the moment, I know at least 4 or 5 initiatives, which are all, we've got the next new Agile. And it's got no basis in theory. It's got no basis in practice, or the practice is partial. So that's one problem. Yeah. The second problem is a wider problem. It's not just the Agile industry, which is this whole desire for maturity models, whether at company level or individual level. So it's really nice to have, you know, a simple score and say, you're here, you need to move here. Oh, and by the way, guess who can help you do it, right? And that's one problem, right? The problem at an individual level is, and Nora Bates, and I was being more reasonable, but I think actually Nora is right on this. She says the individual approaches are actually a modern form of eugenics. And that's particularly true in some of the sort of way that metamodernism has been reinterpreted into adult development theory. Yeah, it becomes a, we are the elite, we understand this, we are privileged, the rest of you are inadequate human beings, right? So I think, you know, I can get into more detail on that, but on individual ones, but that is a deep problem. And I still remember having a fight with Don Beck once at a conference. He's undoubtedly forgotten it, where he was saying, you don't, you know, I'm turquoise level, you're an angry blue, you don't understand it. And I had badges made that night, proud to be brown. I told it wasn't a spiral dynamics color, which meant actually the guys didn't get irony, right? This sort of elitism, I am at a higher level, therefore I can't be expected to discuss it with you until I reach my age of enlightenment. That's not good stuff.
And that's a human thing, right, Dave? Like that's more of a, I guess by saying that it's not just Agilists that have this problem. Like you said, somebody picks up Will, I had a copy over here, just put it away. Will stores the status game, and they read that and they decide that, okay, well, I'm going to apply this model to anything and everything. I'm an expert, read the book, get on my level. That's just us being dumb humans. Yes.
And no, because you don't have to be dumb humans. You can actually be intelligent human beings. You can read around the subject. But it is a particular tendency in Agile because of the certification drive. Yeah, so what you've got in Agile is this really strong desire to create recipes, which is hugely ironic given that Agile was meant to be against things like waterfall.
Indeed.
But then everybody creates rigid recipes and has framework walls. Yeah. So I think it is a particular problem there. And, you know, there are all sorts of things about human nature, which you can go back and find historical examples of. It doesn't mean that they're good or they should be encouraged or they should be justified because we're just being human.
Yeah, there's a paradox by these anti-agile approaches to agile transformations. I want to dive into the first model that we referenced, spiral dynamics, and talk about some of the things that I found intriguing and useful in my practice. And it was maybe it was an aha moment where I understood
these different mindsets and values that were given these artificial color codes as shortcuts, but to understand why a certain approach or a certain language didn't appeal to other people. And then trying to find the common ground, not through elitism, but through, maybe it is elitist, lowest common denominator. But I found that useful. And I'm curious, Ben and Serge, that whole model of understanding the layers and the colors, did you find similar usefulness in it?
I don't know if I would say useful myself. I think there's something kind of therapeutic about reading about different kind of patterns and behaviors and seeing, recognize it and saying, hey, that's not something that we want to be. That's probably about the most that I've gotten out of it, but I haven't necessarily taken it to that level of, trying to get from one level to another or evaluation or anything like that.
So pattern recognition, therapeutics, Serge?
You know, I got introduced to spiral dynamics, and then I saw the practitioners around me do these deep dives, and I tend to be more pragmatic about the work I do and how do we become practitioners. And I got involved in something else. Can't even remember, but I lightly know the material, and I'd have to say what Ben shared, it's a way to share the culture within an organization. It became pretty, where I was working at, like people started using the language to communicate, this is what this culture is like or that culture is like, and don't know enough about it to really have leveraged it in any of the work that I do. I want to make a generalization early on. A theme that I see with the topics that we're starting to speak to is, and this is a question, I guess, and I see it a lot in the recent talks I've been watching you, Dave, put on, which has really, really, I mean, I'm enlightened and support a lot of the perspective. And I started thinking, what's a theme that all of these thought leaders are trying to do? And the question I have for the group is it around trying to create the team, the organization, the system to be able to take the lens and turn it on itself? Because when we have a system be able to turn the lens onto itself, it amplifies the opportunity for new perspectives to emerge. And I think that's where I've been kind of like spiral dynamics, some of these, you know, integral. I mean, it's all about how do I start making the system object? And that's why I took my glasses off. So I'll leave it at that.
You could achieve exactly the same result with astrology. In fact, I did that in IBM. Yeah, we basically cast people's horoscopes. We wrapped it up in management speak and they ascribed huge meaning to it and thought it was wonderful. And then we told them it was astrology, right? We just had our team meeting. We used the Harry Potter sorting hat test for team discussions. Yeah, we're mostly Ravenclaw. We got one Slytherin. I mean, she didn't know she was a Slytherin, but now she's discovered her inner snake. I mean, anything which allows you to take different perspectives has utility in conversation. The problem is when you ascribe accuracy to it. All right. Now, that's the problem. Spiral dynamics. Yeah. If you look at the original research on this from Graves, it's research on his own students in a Midwest college. That's the entire base.
Very narrow.
You can't extrapolate from that to the world. It's heavily culturally biased based on a sort of, you know, liberal enlightenment concept of progress, which disenfranchises two-thirds of the world anyway. Yeah, and I could go on that, but the point is there is absolutely no basis. There is no scientific basis whatsoever in spiral dynamics. Absolutely none. Yeah, but it purports to be scientific. Now, that's the problem. Yeah, and people will therefore take it seriously. So, you know, and as I say, the problem is every time, you know, enough people reach enlightenment, they add a new layer. So turquoise got added by Wilbur, all right? And then of course we have Teal. God help us with Teal, right? Because if you look at that book, yeah, it's a religious tract which only uses half understood examples to support its theory, and doesn't report any data which contradicts the theory. So what you've got is people are weaving a sort of mystical thread of meaning, yeah, which is actually a power dynamic. That's why I think, you know, Nora's right to say this is eugenics. It's an attempt to create power for the people who understand the model and therefore in a privileged point of enlightenment to actually help you through the progress. So it's a form of epistemic injustice. It's a power imbalance. Now, I think you're right when you say the ability for an organization to hold up a lens on itself. Yeah. Now, we, for example, we do that differently. This was an EU-funded project, right? So basically, we'll create a set of data. We'll then get everybody to interpret it and show them the pictures of how they interpreted it differently. And we ascribe no value or statement. We say, you saw it like this, we saw it like this. What does that mean? That achieves exactly the same effect without the elitism and without the pseudoscience.
That, I'm appreciating that.
Dave, I think I'm going to quote, end up quoting you back to yourself, but I think it was you that made the same argument against lean startup, right? Where we only talk about the examples of where it worked. We don't talk about the or hundreds of times that it really hasn't. So by only presenting one half of the argument, you're making an assumption that this is universally applicable, where maybe in some places it really isn't.
Yeah, and well, I mean, we did equivalent research. So if you look at Lean Startup, all right, it went and interviewed people he knew in Silicon Valley who succeeded. You've actually got the same problem, but better researched and good to great. It's a classic error of research to only pick positive examples based on personal preference. Now, we did the same project with Dorothy Leonard from Harvard, right, when I was in IBM. And what we found is all the companies who failed did the same things as the companies who succeeded. The point was you actually had a huge market, so some were bound to succeed anyway. And there are certain things which are common to all entrepreneurs in terms of the way they work. If you look at Good to Great, which is another example, he picks the apex predators. He picks the first into a market who define it. And therefore, they succeed until the market shifts. And now all of those companies are failing because the market is shifting. Right? And that's the problem. It's this false correlation. Yeah. I'm about to launch a major attack on this because you've got people saying, well, we did a study. We identified that, you know, we ran this psychometric test on all leaders. And we identified a correlation between this psychometric test and companies who succeeded. Well, that's not science. I mean, you know, what do you mean by success? How many people did you survey? How are you assuming in a multi-modular system that you can have single causal chains between one psychometric test, which actually asks questions based on the assumption it's right anyway, right? And this is a complex system where you've got so many different modulating factors, there's no way you can trace cause and effect.
That's not even remotely close to good science. It's just, I have an argument, I'm going to find the things that support my argument, and then...
Yeah, but it's fairly standard. It's quite scary. I mean, the psychometric industry is a real problem on this, right? And there are some people who do it with more integrity than others. Some people just, you know, run a survey over thousands of people, say it's science-based, put something together. Other people are genuinely trying to do it. But the problem is they're working within a causal framing and they're assuming they can actually go down to a limited number of causes because, of course, they can't handle the maths if you go beyond a certain level anyway. So they have to eliminate data. Now, it's therefore no surprise if you look at it that most of the major psychology experiments that everybody talks about, attempts to repeat them don't work. Because, of course, the context has now shifted. Yeah. And there's a thing in social science called the Woozle effect, which everybody should know, right? It's based on Winnie the Pooh, and I do not mean the Disney corruption of a wonderfully ironic book, all right? I mean, all copies of the Disney film should be burnt and destroyed for the sake of humanity and literature. But if you go back to the book, all right, you know, Winnie the Pooh goes to meet his friend Piglet, and he walks around a spinney in the snow. And he finds his own footprints and he thinks it's a strange beast called a Woozle. So he walks around again and now there are two Woozles. And then Piglet walks around with him. So now there are two Woozles and a Wizzle. Then they get scared and run off. Now, what you actually see is these patterns established. I mean, there's a debate going on mindfulness at the moment.
I saw that.
Yeah, you get somebody creates this one miracle cure, which is held to cure everything. They gather initial data, which is subject to a Hawthorne effect. Something novel always works the first time. They don't correct for that. And then everybody piles in and the research just repeats and repeats. And it cites the same material without checking the original citations. So I made a big distinction some time ago. I said, look, natural science gives us predictive capability and explanatory capability. Social science gives us explanatory capability, but not predictive. So it's valuable once we recognize that limitation. The trouble is, the minute you ascribe natural science predictability to those sort of results, that's when you move into pseudoscience.
Hmm.
So I want to ask you something, Dave. It's a little tangential, but I think it's relevant here. So I'm glad you brought up the Lulu and the whole reinventing organizations, moving to Thiel. That book drives me. First of all, his editor should be dragged out somewhere and beaten because the book is put together backwards, not to mention the fact that he drones on entirely too long. And I hate the fact that if you're going to use spiral, you spiral, don't cut pieces out of it. Now you create that cognitive dissonance. But one of the famous, I've used famous and gratuitous air quotes for our listeners, utilizations of the Thiel model is Zappos and yeah. Trying to move to holacracy. And I did get a chance to sit down with Brian and discuss holacracy. And I got to be honest, there's a part of me that maybe it's my lizard brain talking about how that's just never going to work. Before we go on to some of these other models, do you have any particular thoughts, Dave, on the idea of holacracy, you know, bureaucraticless?
I'd be careful with lizard brain, by the way. You need to check your neuroscience on that. Triune brain theory is another matter altogether, all right? I mean, there is Olympic evidence, but that's another matter.
Yeah, we have Caitlin coming on to talk about that probably in the new year because she pointed out to us that we're using that term that we shouldn't. But go on, Dave, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, the trouble is Brian's such a nice guy that I haven't launched now. I keep meaning to attack holacracy. And then Brian's such a nice guy, you don't want to beat up the local golden retriever, all right? The reality is holacracy, I mean, and I need to be careful here because we work with two organizations to reverse holacracy because it engenders massive bureaucracy. And I think what you actually see is Brian, like a lot of people in IT, they don't like to manage people because it involves things like empathy and judgment and not being liked from time to time. So what he's done is he's written a computer program so he doesn't have to manage anybody.
Interesting.
All right. And of course, therefore, you've got a set of highly structured constrained protocols. Yeah. Which actually mean that people who are good at playing power, and I need to be very careful what I say here, can play bureaucracy in order to stop people doing things they want to do. Yeah. And it's basically, I mean, sociocracy was bad enough. Holacracy is sociocracy oversimplified anyway. And there again, if you take a naturalistic approach to this, things like we're doing with entangled trios. Yeah. So we're doing distributed decision making now, not with a highly bureaucratic thing, but if three people from three different roles in three divisions make a decision, it stands. Now, that is distributed decision making because it allows human judgment, but it brings variation into the system. We can introduce a time delay so the decision doesn't stand, you know, for 48 hours. But if after 48 hours, nobody objects, it's approved. Right. And that's much more taking a sort of rhizomic approach. Remember, if you introduce a rhizomic element, you get assemblage structures, you get stability. Now, what Brian's done with holacracy is remove all ambiguity. So he's removed all rhizomic elements so the system can't evolve. It's a priori overstructured and overstable. He doesn't get the science. Yeah. But he's such a nice guy.
I'm going to roll back a little bit to sociocracy because there's pieces of it that appeal to me in terms of small circles that have clear decision-making boundaries, but clear interactions with other elements that they influence, and using the model of consent versus consensus. And how does that work in your view? Is that similar to the triad decision that you just described? That's the first time I've heard of it.
Sort of, but it's still, I mean, it's better than holacracy, right? Because it allows a degree of ambiguity. But the trouble is, the issue about consensus and consensus blurs anyway. I'm actually writing about that at the moment. It's very difficult in practice to make a decision between consensus and consent. Because if somebody decides to oppose something and not give consent, they force consensus. Yeah. So consensus relies on compromise. So I say the work we're doing is, and this is, you know, working on a big paper on this for the NHS at the moment, is you move away from individuals. This is important, by the way, because this also tackles spiral dynamics and integral. You start to talk about combinations of roles, not combinations of individuals. And you never have more than three people, possibly five at most, because three people from different backgrounds can reach agreement. The minute you go above that, it becomes political. Yeah. So, and that's where we're moving with entangled trios. So we're entangling roles with no interdependency. We're authorizing those roles to make decisions, mm-hmm. provided they're transparent and visible when they do it. And we're forcing diversity into the trios, but we're keeping the numbers down because we know the science of this. This is a scaffolding issue from biology and kinship group. We know that once you go over that sort of 3 to 5 group, people will start to form factions and fight for their factions, as opposed to actually to have a genuine dialogue. Now, again, the problem with sociocracy, the problem with most peace and reconciliation processes, wonderfully satirized in Derrigals, by the way, is that there's this idea that we'll bring people together and they'll reach agreement if only we have a good conversation. Now, that's, again, that's a highly culturally specific enlightenment model, which basically says if we just give all the people the right decisions and the right information, the right education, they'll magically make the right decisions. Yeah, and it hasn't worked ever since. I mean, we're now talking about Renaissance, not Enlightenment. And if you go to the interest in metamodern scholars, coming on to that one, people like, you know, Lean Anderson and like, they're talking about reintegrating indigenous knowledge into the field, and they're not creating an elitist hierarchical system. That's a Renaissance model. It's kind of like we need to bring back the old and we need to reinvent it. We bring the new stuff. It's what famous philosopher Vico said of the Enlightenment. Yeah, you guys are brilliant, but you're throwing out the good with the bad. Yeah, and we need to do that better integration. There's actually a whole series of webinars with me and Tyson, the Welsh Meet Indigenous Australia. So Tyson and I didn't get to meet, although we got to hug in Sydney Airport. That was about it. But then we worked with JD and his associates. We did a whole day integrating SenseMaker, which is our ethnographic research tool, with Indigenous research methods. So we brought in modern neuroscience with Indigenous narrative knowledge bases and put the two together and created something which is genuinely open. Anything which approaches it, anything from a complexity or modern science point of view, actually handles ambiguity. The problem with all of these methods, the ones we've talked about, is they try and remove ambiguity. Yeah, it's kind of like you should be here. This is, they create categories, they create structures. And the reality is life is ambiguous and unstructured. And we're actually, this is the point Nora Bateson and I are talking about heavily on abductive logic. We evolve to see novel connections and navigate pathways. Yeah. And we, you know, some sacrifices along the way. We didn't evolve to think inductively in highly structured forms.
So, Dave, are you familiar with David Baum's work around dialogue?
Yes. And I think that, again, is an Enlightenment concept. I've had a lot of arguments with Mike Lipsack and others on these.
Okay. But I'm hearing a lot of the coherence, incoherence. Yeah.
It's dialogic, all these sort of things. All right. So the concept. So you bring people together, it's heavily facilitated. So let me illustrate. We have a different approach on both.
That's what I'd love to hear.
So we have two approaches. One is we use a thing called the Trioptychon, which took us about 8 years to develop.
Something amazing is happening in meteorology. Climate researchers are successfully processing a data storm. That's because CDW transformed their laptop devices and infrastructure to pre-configured Lenovo ThinkPads and powerful edge-to-cloud solutions. By delivering faster insights to run more accurate forecast models, it's almost like they're controlling the weather themselves. Lenovo and CDW. Make amazing happen. Find out more at cdw.com/LenovoClient.
Yeah. So we'll have three principals, i.e. people who are deep experts in their field. They're called eagles. Yeah, each of them, and then we can change the numbers, but this is the way it works. So three eagles, 21 ravens. So if I take an academic one, those would be three professors and 21, yeah, fundamentally PhD students, master's programs. So we do the high level and the apprentice, the journeyman, if you want to take a medieval model. Yeah. then the one, and we actually prevent any dialogue. So the first eagle presents, the other two then respond critically. Then all of the ravens go away in small groups of three and discuss what they heard and come back. And then one person from each three sits in a circle. It's called a raven circle. They discuss what they heard. Nobody else can contribute or say anything. They just have to listen. Then we repeat twice more. And then we take the seven groups of three and we make them three groups of seven and they do the synthesis. Yeah. So we actively prevent what Boone talks about in dialogic, because again, that's an enlightenment assumption. Yeah. What we're doing is we note if people can't respond, they listen harder. And this is also linked with a complexity concept of preventing premature convergence. Yeah, so we want to hold off anybody forming opinions for as long as possible. The moment you get into dialogue, you form opinions because that's what dialogue is about. Yeah, and you're making commitments to the process. So that would be an example of an alternative. Yeah, and we use silent listening. We use things like ritual descent, which is one of the most effective methods I've ever created. Yeah, there's a whole body of methods which try and break the two concepts, the concept of dialogue and the concept of facilitation. Because we're actively trying to remove facilitators completely from processes. Right? So when we did our original method development, for example, when I was in IBM, we did it in Copenhagen. So we could facilitate in English, but people would speak in Danish. So we set it up so the facilitator couldn't engage in the content. You were there to orchestrate the dance. Yeah. And I would still hold that. And we now do, like, when we do large group, the facilitation team are on the balcony of a basketball court. They're not allowed on the floor. They're not allowed to engage in the content in any way whatsoever, which is my big problem with things like open space. It's too easy for people to manipulate open space. Yeah. I mean, we saw this. Yeah. And I proved it two or three times. You know, the law of 2 feet means that you walk away from things which are uncomfortable. So that means if you want to dominate open space, you say things that everybody wants to hear. So you're the person they cluster around. Yeah, that's what it rewards.
Right. So you're basically coming back to anyone who's got the inner, who's in touch with their inner sociopath really can use some of these things to the detriment of large groups of others surreptitiously.
And I got to sea level, so I know where my inner sociopath is, and I use it when I need to, all right? And that's the level, all right? I mean, the reality is anything explicit will be gamed, right? And the problem is, and therefore, that's why we go to all the efforts we do on our methods to prevent anybody dominating the group. So coming back to Trioptychon, the eagles can, after they've made their contribution, all they can do is listen. Unless people draw them in on the last process, which is actually very beneficial for them. We did one recently with a farmer. We had commercial R&D and technology. And they'd never really talked with each other before, and they had massive assumptions. At the end of the process, everybody was thoroughly educated in a way they hadn't been before. And we had very different sorts of discussions in the process.
I watched a video. I think it's a genius approach, and very, again, the spirit of being able to really bring to surface, emerge new thinking, new ways of thinking, is the beauty in it.
But again, it comes back to the method development. So we first put it together based on work we'd done on large group facilitation. Yeah. So we put it together, we designed it, we went back to the theory, we produced it. We ran the first one in Whistler, about 4 years ago. And we've now run three in Whistler, two in Taz, three in Snowdonia. The one we just ran in Australia was the first time we felt comfortable enough about it to put it out big time. Because it's still consistent with the theory, but the practice takes time to evolve. Yeah. And again, that's a big problem with most agile methods. I mean, it's like, let's take SAFe, all right? That's Dean throwing together his half-remembered experiences of three clients and producing a certification scheme. Yeah, that's not developing a method which is sustainable. It's developing a construct. Yeah.
Let's switch gears a little bit. How to bring all of this
thinking these approaches into my day job, Serge's, Jay's, Ben's day job, where we're working mostly with North Atlantic mindset, enterprise, some for better or worse, still quarterly shareholder driven performance that have people that want to change to make it a better place to work, but they're being sold many of these other approaches.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a complexity principle. You have to start where people are. Right? Complexity is about starting journeys from the present, not about saying how things should be. So if that's where they are, it's fine. But we have that in IBM. So let me give what I did, right? So we had all these psychometric tests. Everybody was fixated on them. This is a top 300, and I'm meant to be training them. So I introduced the astrology test, but I hid it. And then we got them to assess which was the most effective technique. And astrology won hands down over Myers-Briggs and SDI and everything else. And then we told them what we did. Now, at no point did we tell them what they should think or what they should be. We said, you've been through this process. This is the origin. What do you think that means? Right? Now, that switched it. Right? That was my point about presenting, you saw it like this, they saw it like this, these people saw it like this. And we use non-judgmental signification when we do that. So nothing which is evaluative. Everything has to be descriptive. Yeah? Because the minute you move into evaluation, it becomes a game. And you can say, well, you saw it like this, we saw it like that. Why do you think that's the case? So I was just on a call, for example, into Switzerland with a big company where we're doing this, right? And it's basically what we're about to do is to present the current sort of mission about what the company wants to be, its goals, what it wants to achieve, to the whole workforce, including senior management. Everybody will interpret that, write a story about what it means for them, and then we'll show them the differences. Okay, we're giving you all common data. Yeah, you see it like this, these people see it like that, those people see it like this. This is called a gradient in complexity. What do you think this means? What can we do? Right now, I know what will come out of that from previous cases is people will realize that alignment is not only a mistake, it's not possible. But we talk about coherent heterogeneity rather than homogeneity. Yeah, the last thing you want is everybody to have common mission statements, common values, common beliefs, and be totally aligned around a single mission, because you've just destroyed variety in the system and the system won't evolve anymore. So the issue is, it's this concept of I need enough difference that I can be coherent, but not so much coherence that I lack the difference and lack the evolutionary potential.
Innovation.
Yeah, innovation comes from gradient, from friction. It's the old thing, if everybody's right, everything is equiprobable, so no evolution happens.
Right.
So, Dave, this is, again, I'm sorry to take us on another tangent, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Ben and I have done a lot of work. In a previous life, we worked at the same, we collected a check from the same company. Work is a rather loose term there. we did a lot of stuff along Caitlin Walker's ideas of clean language. And I was curious to hear, you were just talking about alignment is impossible due to different people's POVs and stuff. What are your thoughts on that, that whole idea of less load in language to help arrive at how people see things?
Well, I mean, yes and no, all right. So we make a heavy play on something called epistemic justice. Yeah. Now, Beth, who works for me, has a brilliant way of explaining this, all right? She was also, by the way, on the dialogues with Tyson. So we're both Welsh. We can both come from South Wales. And that was actually quite fascinating, just an aside line on that, because the English tried to eliminate Welsh in Wales in exactly the same way that they tried to eliminate Australian languages at the same time. And that was a big insight for Tyson. He just hadn't realized that it wasn't just a black fella, white fella thing. It was an imperial, non-imperial thing. So those are fascinating for that insight. Yeah. But as I say, one of the ways Beth explains it is, you know, old wives tell tales, old men are philosophers. And that's called epistemic injustice. Yeah. Now, having said that, the trouble is if you play the clean language game, and you shouldn't be rude and you shouldn't swear and such like that. But it's rather like appreciative inquiry, which in the original Coupe Rider mode was really effective. But then it became industrialized to something which always reminds me of the final scene of life, Monty Python's Life of Brian. Everybody's swinging backwards, forwards on the cross, singing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. And so clean language becomes a similar power game because it's a way of excluding people as saying things which people find uncomfortable. And you can see that going on extensively in that. So, yeah, this is it's an Aristotle's golden mean. You need to eliminate deliberately pejorative or exclusory language. But the idea that there's such a thing as clean language and there's a right way of doing things is there. The other thing, to be quite honest, is really unfair on Americans. I can use clean language ironically, and the poor sods don't know what's happening to them. I mean, when I was in IBM, we used to switch irony on and off with HTML code in private chat just to confuse vice presidents of HR. So there's ways of using clean language to be actually more discriminating and more vicious and less honest, to be honest, right? I mean, the human, we've evolved swear words. Swear words are hugely useful. Yeah, I mean, language doesn't, language has evolved to give difference, to give friction, to give all these sort of things. And, you know, full range of it is available to people.
To your point about switching irony on and off, Andy and I are putting together a follow-on show where we're going to grab quotes from thought leaders from LinkedIn and compare them to responses to questions generated by ChatGPT. And we're going to have a panel convened to vote up or down. Is this a bot or not? So did this come from a thought leader or did it come from ChatGPT? Because we were messing around with it, Dave. We were putting just random typical Agile coaching 101 questions through it. And some of the outputs is some of the stuff that we see on LinkedIn day in and day out, which is really kind of disappointing and disconcerting, but also wildly humorous.
It's not a fair test because basically anything thought leaders say is already in the public domain and on the web and all over the place. So it's just reassembling those phrases. And to be honest, if you're speaking, that's what you do. I mean, I do a lot of public speaking.
True.
Yeah. And you've got standard stories, standard phrases, standard concepts. You throw stuff out in the first 10 minutes and then you decide which things you're going to assemble later. Well, human beings are actually better at that than the AI will ever be. But you're not testing the AI's ability to generate original material.
Mm.
Yeah. And given that thought leaders' material is already in the public domain, Yeah. All you're doing is assembling it.
And it might have been you, Dave. Maybe it was an old Jim Rutt episode. It might have been a Jim Rutt interview where you said the problem with AI is we're racing ourselves down to the bottom of stupidity, where it's not that we're getting smarter, we're getting stupider, we're going to meet the AI in the middle. Did I misquote you? Or did I grab the gist of it?
No. What I famously said, I mean, it was on the Jim Rutt show and elsewhere, right, is, two things which are relevant. When, as I said, if you believe in the singularity, your brain is ossified to the point where for you it may be possible, right? Which I didn't know Kerbal was in the audience when I did that. But the other one is kind of like, you know, will AI exceed human beings in intelligence in the next 30 years? Well, yes, because at the moment we're planning to meet them halfway.
That's it.
I'd like to circle back around to Andy's question, Dave. From a pragmatic sense, we're all practitioners. We're all wanting to do work that I'll leave that blank for right now. But work that actually brings teams, maybe this is a good way to say it. I'd like the work that we do is to take teams and enable them or allow them to create the new or to create where they believe they want to go. What's a pathway to the work that you and your organization and your team have created? What's a pathway that we can take and actually begin practicing?
There's some things you do straight away. One is you ban the transformation word.
Second.
That's easy. I don't even use it anymore.
You doom yourself to failure, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would abandon the mindset word.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, mindset occasionally valid, but we now talk about assemblage, affordance, and agency rather than mindset, because that stops it being a purely cognitive model and it stops it being a blame model. The other thing is it's far more important to work out where you are and take small steps forward. And that's what we do with teams. So we start by mapping where we are, and I've just given an illustration, including mapping the differences.
Mm-hmm.
And we say, okay, so we need to shift in this direction. So what do we do next? This is called a micro nudge.
Mm.
So, and you can measure that because it's a vector measure, right? So what you're doing is and this is what I famously call the Frozen 2 strategy, which makes it more memorable.
Oh, the movie.
Okay, Frozen 2 is a great movie. Go watch it. Right? Disney has got really good of late. I mean, their new one on ecology is really good. I mean... And Disney are taking on DeSantis and people and the far right in the States, far more than Democratic Party are. I'm quite impressed, right? And we can come back to Jim Rutt on that later, right? So either way, that in the middle of Frozen 2, the real heroine of the movie, who's the young girl without magic, she's lost in a sort of pit of despair and despondency. She thinks her sister is dead, her mentor is dead. And she thinks this beautiful song, "All I Can Do Is Do the Next Right Thing." Well, in complexity, that's called the adjacent possible. Yeah. So what you do is, where are we? What can we do next? Then we'll look again. Then we'll look again. Then we'll look again. And that's called a series of micro nudges. And in Kinevin terms, the more complex it is, the more you move to several adjacent possibles simultaneously and see what happens.
I think I heard you speak positively earlier about Lena Rachel Anderson's work. And I think it's kind of termed Bildung, I think is what she calls it, in terms of being able to enable people to grow into whatever they ought to be. That's awkwardly put, but
she doesn't have the hierarchy. I mean, she's actually right. An eagle for us. We're running a triopticon around the future of education in South Wales next April. She's one of the three eagles.
Okay, cool.
So she's there, right? But if you look what then happens, if you go on to the sort of Nordic school, particularly Gortz and Friest, right? They then convert that into a hierarchy.
Right.
And this is my big problem, right? You can see it also with, you know, good friends of mine like Daniel Schumacher and the like, right? They're basically creating this elitist structure in which the metamodern is the transcendent humanity, drug-induced, augmented, you know, by technology, whatever. And they're the enlightened ones. And you can see this with this total bloody Game B nonsense, which Jim Rutt is promoting, right? Which is a classic bit of lotus eating, because if you get everybody talking about getting rid of the parasite from their back, and I mean, it's appalling stereotypes of indigenous archetypes in it, which is really cultural appropriation. And basically, the neo-right love that sort of stuff. The far-right love that sort of stuff because you're all distracted talking about how things should be. So you don't engage with reality. And Jim is now heavily playing, I mean, the one thing in the States, all right, the minute somebody talks about free speech, these days it's code for far right. And you get this, you know, we're okay about this. Everybody's voice should be heard. Bang, 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 bang. What it means is it's actually that is a far right trope at the moment in terms of the way it works. And we can see this new age becomes a distraction from engaging with political reality. Yeah, and that's the problem with Game B. It's also the problem with a lot of integral movements. It's a lot of problems with all of these hierarchical movements. And it's the big problem with things like the internal development goals, which is a total disaster. Because a lot of good people are now focused on, well, we need to change ourselves internally and get everybody to think like us. And only then will we solve global warming. Well, by the time you get that, so it will all be over, right? It's a distraction. And I say, it's
that's right.
I called it lotus eating the other day. Then I got really depressed because somebody didn't know what I was talking about. Yeah. And then I sort of mentioned, I mean, I had it the other day. I mentioned the wine dark sea. All right. And somebody, that's a brilliant phrase. Did you invent it? And I said, well, along with rosy fingered dawn. And they didn't know what I was talking about. So as I say, you know, you can make these references now and then you realize you're playing intellectual Western elitism and you need to stop. Right. So yeah, recognize that. But lotus eating, if you go back to Homer, that's really important because one of the things that maturity models do is they allow people to be distracted from current reality by talking about idealized future states. And that's one of the other reasons why a lot of executives love it, because what they want to do is launch, it's like SAFE, right? Let's take SAFE or any big change program. And I lived in this in IBM. You knew the minute a massive change program was announced that the executive would move on before the consequences were known. And Dean played to that brilliantly. You know, $5 million investment, we're all going agile, and then I'll move on before the consequences start to hit, because actually I'll just cycle around initiative on initiative on initiative. We actually had a rule in data sciences before IBM took us over. If you were a general manager, you had to stay in post for 3 years.
You couldn't wiggle out after 18.
We didn't let people swap in less than 3 years, because then you couldn't do that.
Right. It's the whole Nassim Taleb skin in the game thing, where if you've got skin in the game, you're going to think a little bit differently than if it's easy. It's easy for me as a consultant to come in, you know, printer goes burn and give you a bunch of PowerPoints, as opposed to actually in it to win it.
Yeah, and what happens if you implement it, then you become a safe fellow, then you become a safe consultant. I mean, yeah, don't take me down that route, all right?
Yes, might be a good time to put a pin in it.
Let Ben get his one question in, Andy, and then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, it's a little bit on the simpler side, but if so, to me, there's this theme of this conversation of the snake oil salesman side of it, and people kind of saying, coming from the kind of position of saying, I know better than you, I'm going to help guide you to where I am. That's hugely problematic. To me, that sort of goes across all these different things that we've talked about. But if people kind of just look at some of these things on their own, as inaccurate as they might be, but they find some sort of realization about themselves, or they get some sort of value out of it, is it that bad if that's all that happens to it?
Well, the problem is it won't be all that happens to it.
Fair point.
Right. And there are better places to start, to be honest. All right. So as I say, my view is if you want to create a hierarchical set of categories, use something which is just straight fun, like astrology or the Harry Potter sorting hat or something. You get the same effect and people don't take it too seriously.
Research shows that you're avoiding that.
What I'm going to hit, all right? So that's kind of like one factor on that I would look at, right? And there's a whole bunch of other things. So we've got, cognitively diverse groups, we've got ethnically diverse, we've got culturally diverse groups. All of these things come from a very specific culture, and they privilege an ability to speak in a certain way. Yeah. And that actually means you're removing dissent or variety from the system. Yeah? Mm. So I think there are far more authentic ways of doing it without the sort of problems that you can handle there, right? But I do think there is this addiction to facilitation. We had this real problem when we were working in IBM on narrative, is that we wanted people to develop their own narrative and theme, but some of our facilitators couldn't cope with that, because they got their rocks off on interpreting people's narratives and helped them to emerge it, to emerge ideas. Yeah? And that's the problem. It's like the old adage of, anybody who wants to be a politician automatically disqualifies themselves. I'm tempted to see the same thing about facilitators.
I've always said the same thing. It's anybody who willingly says I could be president, they should automatically be removed from the ability to do so, because that just shows there's something else there.
But there's this other big thing, which is that the problem is the focus on the individual and individual change. Right? Now, this is also in the Tyson conversation. So there is a North Atlantic norm, which actually comes from the Reformation and Protestantism. That's its origin, which says all systems are assemblies of individual interests and individual choices. And therefore, to change the system, you change individuals. If you go into Africa, Asia, Latin America, Indigenous Australia, the Celtic fringe of the UK, then they're tribal. So identity comes from the tribe, not from you. Tribe isn't somebody's interest. Now, that's the big switch in organizations. And that's what we're doing with things like entangled trios. and a whole body of methods and tools, is we're moving towards collective identities, not individual identities. Right? And that's the switch from mindset, because you can give agency to a triad rather than individual. You can change the assemblage, all of those sort of things. The language focuses you on changing the ecosystem rather than trying to change people. And the key complexity lesson is if you change the links between people, they will change. And it's a lot more economic and a lot more moral to change how people interact than to try and tell them what sort of people they should be.
It's the space between teams that you put in certain conditions to enable what you're speaking to them.
And there's also a thing called the tyranny of the explicit. I mean, again, it's a facilitator problem. They can't cope with people learning unless they express their learning. It's because a huge amount of techniques come sideways from psychotherapy. And the problem with psychotherapy, it assumes that you are in a state of psychosis and you need a therapist. And psychotherapy is you have to make everything explicit so that you've honest. Well, actually, in organizational change, if people are changing, it doesn't have to be explicit. It doesn't have to be written down. It doesn't have to be articulated. And certainly when it is articulated, it's just a set of platitudes on a whiteboard, which mean nothing anyway.
Dave, we're coming near the end of our time. Brad, I would love to have you back sometime soon to talk about the tyranny of the annual performance review, which is holding in place the individual contributor bullshit that you just mentioned, and not driving towards a collective mindset.
You use the mindset word.
Whoops, sorry.
and you used the collective word with it as well, so it got really bad. No, we're actually doing work.
Is really unclean.
We're using Gemba systems now, so this is continuous feedback at a micro and team level, both individual and team. And it's lots of micro feedback in real time, and then we look for patterns over the whole year. Yeah, and that actually works. So very happy to come and talk about that.
That would be wonderful. Well, thanks again, Dave, Ben, Serge, Jay, for the time. Listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, give us a review, a rating, leave comments on your podcast platform of choice. We'd like to continue the discussion. What about, how your star sign impacts achieving your OKRs? Send this on the Discord server. See your show notes for how I spelled
it. I'm Aries with Libra rising, by the way. And
okay.
and you know, Virgos I can work with, but Taurians, forget it. All right, it's always been true for my entire life, so I worry about that one.
Right? It's great that you could see and recognize the pattern in hindsight and use it moving forward. So until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast signing out.
That was fun, guys. Yeah.
Yes. Thanks.
That was
fun. It was. That was really fun. I mean, I felt like we could go another couple hours. Thank you so much, Dave. Much appreciated.
Join us today during the Jeep Celebration event. Right now, get 20% below MSRP for an average of $15,178 under MSRP on the purchase of a 2023 Jeep Grand Cherokee Overland 4xe or Summit 4xe. Not compatible with lease offers or with any other consumer incentive offers. $15,178 average based on 20% below average MSRP from all 2023 Grand Cherokee Overland 4xe and Summit 4xe models in dealer stock. Residency restrictions apply. Take retail delivery from dealer stock by 4/1. Jeep is a registered trademark.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.